Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Tom Withers. I'm from the Savannah firm of Gillen, Withers, and Lake. I represent the defendant appellant here, Derek Penninger. I would like to focus, with the court's indulgence, on three issues: the denial of the motion for continuance, errors at trial that affected the fairness, we believe, of the proceeding, and the issue of the lack of notice on the upward departure. With the court's permission, I'll address each of those in reverse order, starting with the lack of notice concerning the upward departure. This case was originally scheduled for sentencing on April 12th of 2009. Mr. Penninger had been convicted at trial following a one-week trial that stretched from September into the early days of October, I believe. On April 8th, the government filed a sentencing memo, and in that sentencing memo, the government argued that the facts, while egregious in this case, have been taken into consideration under and accounted for under the guidelines. Now, as we know, Mr. Penninger absconded, failed to appear at his originally scheduled sentencing in April. That issue is not before this court. The prosecutor and the district court, I would submit, believed that the testimony, allegedly perjurious, of Mr. Penninger at trial was not accounted for under 3C1.1, the obstruction issue with respect to the guidelines. But the PSR in the addendum and in the original PSR both addressed that in addition to the violation of 18 U.S.C. 1001, the false statement conviction, that Mr. Penninger had earned an obstruction for his commission of perjury at trial, as set forth in both the original PSR and in the addendum. Fast forward to sentencing in June. Shortly before that sentencing, the government filed a motion that was styled as a motion for upward departure, and in that motion, the government argued that Mr. Penninger's absconding warranted a two-level.
Do you think that notice can be fairly read to suggest it was also a notice as to perjury and other obstruction of justice?
I do not, even because there are.
I'm not suggesting that it can. I'm just asking.
There are two separate sections of that, one of which is in the.
I understand you're asking. Let me ask you another question. Are you claiming there's, if in fact there's obstruction of justice, not absconding, but obstruction of justice was used for the upward departure, you claim double counting?
Well, it would be double counting, but it's a lack of notice under Rule 32.
But are you claiming double counting?
That's what I would claim for the purpose of proving prejudice, Your Honor. There would be two components. Number one is there a violation of Rule 32 for failure to provide that notice?
Well, let's ask you this much. Do you think that the notice under H there, Rule 32, the court must give the parties reasonable notice, do you think that the PSR provided by an officer of the court, can that provide notice?
Oh, yes.
It can?
Certainly.
But you think it would have to, in this case, the PSR talks about obstruction of justice.
No doubt.
But you would say it would have to say basis for an upward departure?
Absolutely.
Now, in fact, did the court give any such formal notice?
No.
Then why wouldn't we analyze this then under harmless error?
Because the PSR addresses the issue of 3C1.1 enhancement, both in the original PSR and in the addendum. It was objective.
I understand that, but you understand my point. The obstruction of justice issue, not counting absconding, is at play in that pre-sentence report. That didn't surprise you that was part of sentencing or that the client was going to be charged with obstruction of justice, I mean for enhancement or other purposes. So it's in play. It's not out of the blue. It's in play. Don't you think that's fair?
It is.
You can argue that's not sufficient, but it's at play there, don't you think?
It is in play with respect to whether it's going to be an enhancement or not, two-level enhancement under 3C1.1.
You've already said there was not formal notice of any basis from that being an upward departure. So that formal notice to meet the rules specifically is off the table. I'm just asking if that in fact happened and there wasn't formal notice. I don't see where it is. Maybe the government's going to tell us where it is. But if we accept that and we would say that's error, why wouldn't the analysis just then be under harmless error? And the defendant knew that was at play and that was a factor, and the court could consider it that way. Didn't give formal notice, but it would be no error that we would recognize, because it's not like being caught flat-footed by it. It's at play. You understand my question?
I do understand that issue. I would draw the distinction, though, Your Honor. It is at play with respect to whether it's going to be an enhancement under 3C1.1. That's an entirely different question, whether it is at play with respect to whether there's going to be an upward level, two-point upward level departure. And you can see, actually, in the...
But it would have to be set up in this case, in the scenario, I think, for harmless error analysis to be applied, because that's what may or may not make it harmless. There's error already. To get to the harmless analysis, you say it has to be formally noticed, which takes out the harmless analysis, in my opinion. Do you understand my question? You may not agree with where it takes you, but do you see what I mean?
I think I do. I didn't follow everything.
The question of obstruction of justice is at play at sentencing in this case.
It was.
Under the enhancement. But because it's only mentioned in enhancement and not upward departure,
true,
you may well have a claim that is error. But I'm just wondering, because of what makes it an error, no formal announcement, mm-hmm, by the court.
Yes, sir.
Seems to me then you'd be able to shift to harmless error analysis, but it can't just be defeated by the fact that proper notice wasn't given.
I would say two things with respect to that. Number one is it would be double counting if the court is going to use that for the purpose of an upward departure, because it has already been accounted for in the guidelines.
Just let me ask you a factual question. Did the court point to different things? I just have a recollection. I don't have the record in front of me right this second. Maybe for the enhancement, some things he did that could be considered not absconding now, but obstruction of justice, and others that would form the basis of the upward departure. There's no distinction in the factual scenario underlining each one of those.
The court did go through a rationale for his upward departure, and he talked about the false statement that formed the basis for the 1001 conviction. Talked about number two, the alleged perjurious testimony at trial, and number three, absconding. He said he was going to reject numbers one and two because those had already been, the absconding would have to be addressed in the subsequent prosecution. Right. The 1001 had already been factored into the guidelines, but that the 3C1.1 did not take into consideration the perjurious testimony. And that's where I think the harmless error comes in, analysis, and where we went on the harmless error, because, in fact, the PSI did identify that alleged perjurious testimony as a basis for the 3C1.1 enhancement. And you can see my confusion in the transcript, and there's some discussion back and forth between counsel for both the government and the defendant in terms of exactly what's going on, because I talked to the court about, well, then you're applying a four-level enhancement under 3C1.1, which would be double counting, which brings us to the issue, is therefore harmful error.
Mr. Withers, can we talk about variances for a second?
Yes, Your Honor.
Judge Shedd and I served together, and Judge Shedd wrote an excellent opinion, and it's not cited in the briefs, and maybe it came out after the briefs were filed. And I can't quite remember the name, Sauvignon something, in which basically we agreed that post-Booker, whether it's a variance or a departure, although we understand the importance of the difference in terms of notice, couldn't the judge have done this by way of a variance sentence? And you'd have no claim whatsoever, right?
I think that's accurate.
Doesn't that factor into harmless error analysis, or does it?
I don't think so, because the court didn't address it as a variance.
Your argument then, if we agree with you on the notice issue, we send it back and the judge does the same thing and calls it a variance.
Could the judge do that? Candidly, yes.
Okay. I appreciate your candor.
With that said, I would like to very briefly address the issue of the denial of the motion for continuance. The record, as we read it, is virtually silent on what takes place in this case between January and May 20th of 2009, indictment in January, appointment of second trial counsel May 20th. There are two in March and then in May, there are two continuances. They just appear as docket entries, ends of justice continuances. And then when Mr. Kuhn gets into the case, trial counsel, I think he does what diligent trial counsel would do. He is interviewing his client, sees that there's clearly a mental impairment issue, and he files a motion for psychiatric examination. He also understands that there are all these computers out there that have been seized by the government, and he seeks funds to have the computers analyzed. At the hearing on the motion for continuance, and this is where I think both the government and the district court take a wrong turn, the blame is suddenly shifted to Mr. Penninger for, as the government says, malingering, which I don't think is an accurate read of the silent record in terms of why these earlier continuances have been granted. And the district court, in addressing the issue, addresses Mr. Penninger and says, you know, this case is going to be tried. It's been pending for 2 years. That is the erroneous factual premises that the district court relies upon in denying the motion for continuance.
He sort of misspoke. He meant the investigation had been ongoing for 2 years, more than 2 years.
He actually addresses the issue of the case pending for more than 2 years. It certainly would seem to me to be reasonable if the government had had 2 years for an investigation. Nothing takes place in this case for the first 5 months under indictment, that counsel, Mr. Kuhn, trial counsel, in trying to catch up and in trying to prepare, should have a reasonable time for preparation. And with respect to the issue of the harmfulness of the district court's decision there, I think that Mr. Kuhn articulates two things. One is the difficulty in dealing with his client in terms of having the mental impairment issue affecting everything, that every issue, I believe is what he says, in terms of his preparation. And two, a denial of the ability to properly review the evidence. And we would submit that the district court's focus on that wrong factual premises and insisting upon going to trial denied Mr. Penninger the effective assistance of counsel at trial. The third issue, Your Honors, would be the various issues that occurred at trial that denied Mr. Penninger a fair trial, either individually or cumulatively. The first issue there would be the district court's admission of certain bank records that were admitted because, as the government pronounced, that they had been obtained by the grand jury, and the district court announced, well, anything that has been obtained by subpoena from the grand jury is admitted. The Third Circuit Court in Pelello, if I'm pronouncing that right, addressed the same factual scenario, finding that the agent was not a proper custodian for the introduction of bank records, and in fact it reversed in that case. Second, and more strangely, Ms. Muka, from the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, testified about information that she had received from some 200 to 300 commodities traders from around the country. She testified over objection and didn't identify documents, but just testified on the basis of what those records provided to her. And again, these are records being provided to her in response to a subpoena, and that error was compounded because then she compares those records with what the inadmissible bank records were in the first instance. And I would submit to you that Ms. Mooka's testimony is not provided for by any rule of evidence. And finally, I would submit to you that the issue of Michael LaDoyne III's conviction and his role in the offense that the government, in anticipation of the defense, dangerous thing for government counsel to do, commented about what the defense may be in that respect, asked the FBI agent about Mr. LaDoyne's conviction, but when defense counsel tried to plow that ground, prohibited defense counsel from going there. That was, in fact, a theory of defense, and post-trial, and this is analyzed in the context of a motion for new trial, but post-trial...
Are you borrowing time from your rebuttal time now?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay. That, you might want to ask...
I'm sorry.
Somebody judge if you can do that.
I'm sorry. May I proceed and just round out this one?
Yeah, I noticed that you presumptuously did so, but decorum is to note the red light and ask for permission, but I'll let you go on because Judge Shedd asked you some very, very important questions, so please finish up in the next 60 seconds.
I will. I apologize for not following.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Decorum. With respect to the motion for new trial analysis, Your Honor, the Bonita May, one of the alleged victims, testified very powerfully against Mr. Penninger. And we find out in post-trial that it was, in fact, her daughter who had signed a bank document that turned into a 2014 bank false bank statement conviction for Mr. LaDoyne, providing a basis of cross-examination that we would have thought was appropriate under the circumstances.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I apologize.
No problem. Mr. DeHart?
May it please the Court, Your Honor. My name is Rhett DeHart. I'm from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Charleston, South Carolina. And just a few issues in rebuttal, Your Honor. As to the lack of notice, I think the record makes clear that Mr. Penninger was put on notice on multiple occasions, that he faced an increased penalty for his obstruction of justice in multiple ways. And I'd point, Your Honor, to the record at the government's motion for an upward departure is in the joint appendix at 749, and we noted that, quote, Penninger already received an enhancement for obstruction of justice when he was convicted of lying to the FBI before trial.
949, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's just 749.
Forgive me, Your Honor, it is 949. And it said that Penninger already received an enhancement for obstruction when he was convicted of lying to the FBI before trial, and he obstructed of justice again when he committed perjury at trial. And we noted that he obstructed justice before trial, during trial, and after the trial in three separate ways, but he only got one enhancement for obstruction.
Well, how does that say that?
Your Honor, it says, quote...
Let me just wait. You think that sentence makes that point?
Quote, Penninger obstructed justice before the trial, during the trial, and after the trial in three separate and distinct ways.
Right. Where does that say that that hadn't already been factored in to enhancement?
Even though Penninger, in the next sentence, Your Honor, even though Penninger obstructed justice in numerous ways, he can receive only one enhancement for obstruction of justice under the sentencing guidelines. Right. It would be unjust and contrary to the spirit of the sentencing guidelines if Penninger did not receive an additional enhancement for obstruction of justice at sentencing. Your Honor, if you flip over to the actual sentencing itself on page 1007, Your Honor, we again provided notice, and it said, Your Honor.
But first, let's just stop on the letter. How does that, just asking, where does that letter provide notice that you are seeking any kind of upward departure for anything other than for the absconding?
Your Honor, I think it notes, it's not a letter, it was a motion for an upward departure, but it did list that he absconded.
Well, I've read that, but it doesn't say you're asking for it on that basis. Do you think it does?
Your Honor, I think it puts him on notice that we're seeking an enhancement for obstruction of justice because basically what
we're absconding.
Well, but we notice, and it's pretty clear in there.
No, wait, you know, but you don't. I just want you to do this for me. I think maybe you pointed to it. Is that the strongest language in your motion that indicates it's for something other than merely absconding? Have you pointed out that language?
It is, but if you look at the Joint Appendix 1007, Your Honor, actually at the Senate scene, we clarify it further.
But that doesn't count, does it?
Well,
notice at the sentencing doesn't count for notice that's required under the rules, does it?
Well, I think it does in the sense, and if you let me read this, well,
I don't think it does.
Well, it seems like to me he could.
You have to let me finish.
Well, forgive me.
I don't think it does because then that just completely vitiates the requirement of notice. All that means is, under your reading, it would just say when the judge makes it clear why he's doing it, that's enough notice. I don't think that's the rule.
Well, Your Honor, let me make this one point, and you may well be right, Judge. This is where we're going. Is on 1007, we clarify that on line 13, Your Honor. I say, Judge Duffy, quote, based on the absconding, Your Honor, and based on his perjury at trial, we would ask for a two-level upward departure. Now, if that was the situation where Mr. Penninger thought he wasn't on notice, he could say, "Whoa, Your Honor, we only thought we got notice on the absconding, and you know, Mr. DeHart's saying it's on the absconding and the perjury." He could have asked for a continuance. Seems like to me that was before Judge Duffy granted sentencing, so we certainly gave him verbal notice. And I think Judge Duffy agreed with that, Your Honor, because if you look at
let me say this. I think it's fair. At that point, you're making it clear. You look to be seeking it for both reasons.
Yes, sir.
I just personally couldn't find it clearly enough for me in the motion, and I don't know that we'll resolve it. You pointed out what you think is the strongest language in the motion itself.
Yes, sir.
What about double counting? What about double counting as far as prejudice under harmless error, if I were to go?
Your Honor, I think it is clear from the record that it's sort of an odd rule that notice is not required if Judge Duffy decides to vary upward to take care of absconding. Clearly, the no notice is required, but if he wants to do it pursuant to a upward departure, notice is required. That seems from the...
So you base it on the fact that it's the variance versus departure, harmless error, rather than...
Yes, sir.
Not double counting?
Yes, sir. I mean, I think we would all agree that had the motion would have been styled as a motion for a departure and variance, we wouldn't be here. I mean, clearly, Judge Duffy...
He called it a variance in his statement of reasons.
Yes, sir, he did. That's my point. I think it clearly is harmless error. I mean, Judge Duffy could vary two levels upward. He could depart two levels upward. There's no question he could do that. He noted as a variance and a departure... And he certainly understood that. I mean, if you look at...
Before you go that, just let me ask you this specifically, though. And I understand the argument about the variance versus departure, but I'm taking it back one step. We get to the variance for one second. If we didn't look at that analysis, which, of course, we can, under just the facts of the case and the upward departure, was there double counting on... And by that, I mean, did he use the same activity specifically for the enhancement?
No, sir.
And the same activity for the upward departure under the upward departure for obstruction of justice.
No, sir. I think what it is clear.
But you understand my point?
I think I do.
It seems to me that makes it even a second or separate type of harmless error analysis. One could be the variance versus the departure, but one could just be if he's on notice that obstruction of justice, not absconding, but obstruction of justice in other fashions is in front of the court. You lose the double counting argument for prejudice on the harmless error, maybe, if you use two different incidents of obstruction. One maybe be before trial and one maybe be in testimony during trial. That's what I'm asking you.
Yes, sir, and I agree with that. And I'd go one step further. I think that we made clear in our motion that there were three bases of obstruction of justice. So, you know, that he obstructed justice before trial and he was convicted of the 1001 lying to the FBI. So he got an enhancement for obstruction of justice with that. Judge Duffy found beyond any doubt at sentencing that he committed rampant perjury at trial. That's another basis for obstruction of justice. and the absconding is a third basis. But under the guidelines, you can only get – it's odd.
I know that, but I'm asking – but what I'm asking is his decision to apply the enhancement under 3C, is it clear that he used only the conviction of lying to the FBI for that basis, and then he used the upward departure basis being the perjury at trial? That's what I'm asking.
Your Honor, it is clear, and I would point you to 10 – I believe this answers your question, yeah. Judge Shedd. If not, I apologize. But when Judge Duffy addressed Mr. Withers' motion on JA 1041, line 13, he says, thank you in response to Mr. Withers. I think the government's motion was based upon the trial testimony and the absconding.
So you think that makes it clear that the upward departure then is based on the trial testimony
and the absconding? Yeah, the Judge Duffy, Your Honor, from my perspective, unless I'm completely missing something, Mr. Withers, this is right after he makes that objection, he makes a clarification. Judge Duffy says, quote, for the record, I think the government's motion for an upward departure was based upon the trial testimony and the absconding. And in any event, Your Honor, I do think it by any measure is harmless error, because there was a situation at the end of the sentencing where the probation officer, on 1034, the probation officer stood up and said, Judge Duffy, you can actually give him more than 240 months. These counts can be stacked. And Judge Duffy says, I don't want to do that, even though I can. I'm going to be limited to the statutory maximum, because I think that was the intent of the Congress. I don't want to make too much of that, but it sure seems like Judge Duffy was given ample opportunity to sentence him above 240 and below 240, and he says on JA 1034, thank you very much, Mr. Probation Officer. I understand I can go above it. I'm going to limit it to the statutory maximum. That was the intent of Congress, and I think that's the appropriate thing to do. And my point is there, is I think, Your Honor, it would be a pointless waste of resources to remand this case, because there's really no doubt Judge Duffy is going to give him 240 months if it's remanded. And I think it would waste Your Honor's resources, and it would waste the district court resource. And I'm sorry if I wasn't more clear about that in my brief. Your Honor, the second issue regarding the denial of the motion continuance, I would note for the record that Judge Duffy continued this case twice. This was Mr. Penninger's third motion for continuance, and for him to prevail, he's got to prove that Judge Duffy's decision to deny a third continuance was arbitrary and unreasoning. And the case was continued twice, and the two factors that the government advanced and the district court accepted in denying a third continuance was because the victims in this case were disproportionately older, and the investigation had been pending for more than 2 years. So I think Judge Duffy noted in the record, given the age of the victims and the length of the investigation, that's an appropriate basis to deny a third continuance. It's not as if he denied one continuance. He granted two continuances over the government's objection. He had to draw a line somewhere. Your Honor, we would argue it would be hard for Your Honor to find that Judge Duffy abused his discretion by granting a third continuance. Two continuances seems fair. And I would note, Your Honor, for the record, in terms of justifiable delay, Mr. Penninger waited 6 months until after he was arraigned to request a forensic examination of a computer. He waited 6 months until after he was arraigned to request a psychiatric evidence. And lastly, Your Honor, I don't think he can show any prejudice from this denial of a third continuance, because he abandoned the mental health defense prior to sentencing. And regarding the computer evidence, Your Honor, there was no evidence introduced at trial from Mr. Penninger's computer. He had 10 months to search his computer. Because he absconded, he was sentenced 10 months after his trial, which is obviously longer than most. He had 10 months to finish this computer search, and he didn't introduce any evidence or one document at sentencing that wasn't helpful. He made no arguments at sentencing that the information from his computer helped him. So Mr. Penninger can point to no evidence from his computers that would have been introduced at trial had the case been continued a third time. So not only did Judge Duffy not abuse his discretion in denying a third continuance, Mr. Withers can show no prejudice. Lastly, Your Honor, or second to lastly, there was some discussion about this investigator from the Commodities Future Trading Commission. Ironically, Judge, in Mr. Penninger's brief, he initially cites some documents that were introduced through this investigator. Your Honor, that's not correct. If she just testified, no documents were introduced through Ms. Muka, the CFTC investigator. All the documents were introduced through the FBI without objection, Your Honor. And ironically, she testified to two things, to analysis of the bank records. There was no objection to her testifying regarding Mr. Penninger's bank records. She did testify about some trading records. And ironically, the trading records show more trading than actually occurred because it included a different Michael Penninger and some individual victims. And it is ironic from the government's perspective that he, on the one hand, objected to her testifying, but in his closing argument, he actually cited the CFT investigator's testimony as proof that there was some trading occurred because it was a slightly higher number. And I don't see how, on the one hand, he could object to her testifying, but on the other hand, in his closing argument, cite her testimony in support of his case. Now, it was still a very little trading. I mean, I think the evidence showed that out of $7.2 million, about $65,000 was used to trade futures. She actually had a slightly higher number because there was another Michael Penninger unrelated to the case. But he cited her testimony in closing, so the government can't quite understand how that would be prejudicial to Mr. Penninger, even if she shouldn't have testified to that, and we take the position that it was a hearsay exception, both to the business records. And
well, of course, you make the lemonade with the lemons you're left with.
Yes, sir, but the government didn't make that lemonade. And
well, you introduced the evidence. I mean,
we did, and we're not.
You can't fault defense counsel in closing argument for trying to.
We don't fault him, Your Honor, but I do think at the end of the day, it sort of seems hard for him to say Judge Duffy abused his discretion where this woman testified to two different analyses. One was a little bit more favorable, but still very damning.
It really goes to your prejudice point.
Absolutely.
More so than to the admissibility.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and just for the record, we do take the position that her testimony was accepted from the hearsay rule in both business records and the public agency exception. But I don't see how he can show specific prejudice given that he actually cited her testimony in his closing as evidence that there was some trading. Lastly, Your Honor, I think Mr. Penninger made some argument about this fellow, the bank records. He claims that the bank records are inadmissible, Judge. We would note in our supplemental joint appendix that the government pre-authenticated these bank records prior to trial pursuant to Rule 90211. It's beyond any doubt we provided written notice. The trial counsel agreed that we could authenticate those records pursuant to certifications. Your Honor, it's also undisputable that the bank records were accepted from the hearsay rule. So of all the issues in the brief, I think this one lacks the most merit. And finally, Your Honor, this does frustrate the Justice Department because we complied with Rule 90211. We got the certifications, and we authenticated the bank records prior to trial. We showed it to them at the exhibit conference. The trial counsel agreed that we could do this. He actually used the same rule to authenticate his bank records. And from the government's perspective, it's frustrating because at trial, he never objected to the bank records on the basis of hearsay or authentication. It was some he's confusing the objections he made to the trading records as opposed to the business records. But he never said, Your Honor, we object to these business records basis on hearsay or authentication. He just said, same objection. We think it was an objection based on Rule 602, lack of personal knowledge. But bottom line is, he didn't put us on notice. His objection was insufficiently specific. And had he said, Your Honor, we object to those bank records on hearsay, we object on the basis of authentication, it would have allowed us to respond and say, Your Honor, we pre-authenticated them. We have their certifications here. We can introduce them in the record. But if you look closely at those objections, he simply did not object to the bank records on the basis of hearsay or authentication. As Your Honor knows, you can't switch rationales in midstream. You can't put a very vague objection in the district court and come up with an entirely new objection on the Court of Appeals. But I would note for the record, if you look at the supplemental joint appendix, we have the certifications in record, we have the written notice in record, and there's simply no doubt whatsoever that those bank records were authenticated and are exceptions to the hearsay rule. And lastly, Your Honor, this situation about there were numerous victims, six victims testified at trial, three case agents. One of them, Ms. May, Mr. Withers argued that Judge Duffy, I think his argument was that he insufficiently limited the cross-examination. We would note for the record that what he's trying to do is her son-in-law was convicted in an unrelated mortgage fraud, and he wanted to impeach this witness because her son-in-law was convicted in an unrelated fraud. And, Your Honor, as you all know, under Rule 609, a witness testimony can be impeached if they had been convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor involving deceit. But Rule 609 does not allow a witness to be impeached by evidence that a separate family member was convicted of a crime. So I think Judge Duffy was trying to avoid a trial within a trial, but the rules of evidence do not allow a witness to be impeached because something that her son-in-law did in an unrelated case. So I can't fill up. The government just doesn't understand how that was relevant. Judge Duffy was trying to avoid a trial within a trial. He allowed Ms. May to be cross-examined extensively. Her testimony was cumulative. It was corroborated by all the other evidence at trial. And even absent her testimony, there was overwhelming evidence of guilt. So I don't think Mr. Withers can explain how, under the rules of evidence, a witness can be impeached because her in-law was convicted of a separate crime. And I think it would have been error for Judge Duffy to allow it. He certainly didn't abuse his discretion by allowing it.
The court gave him opportunities to proffer why it might be relevant.
Your Honor, it didn't actually. This is another situation where he did at the sidebar. But this is another situation where Penninger is changing rationales. In front of, at the sidebar with Judge Duffy, the defense counsel said, we'd like to ask Ms. May about this to show that, you know, she placed unreasonable faith in this person. But basically what he was trying to do was confusing. He was trying to say, we would like to cross her about LaDoyan's conviction, basically to show LaDoyan was responsible for the Ponzi scheme. But on an appeal, they present an entirely separate issue, and now the theory now is he should have been allowed to cross-examine her to show that somehow that she was testifying to protect her daughter. None of that was brought forth below. That's an entirely new ground on appeal. That's news to us, and that Judge Duffy didn't abuse his discretion in trying to limit a trial within a trial. And lastly, Your Honor, I've got 10 seconds left. I would note this LaDoyan fella keeps coming up. He was not a witness at trial, and he was not a witness at the grand jury. He was just one of 40 people interviewed, so it's not as if he was a defendant or a witness.
All right. Thank you, Mr. DeHart. Mr. Withers, you have some time reserved.
Excuse me. Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to make 4 points briefly. One, with respect to the issue of the downward departure, I believe that the analysis on this...
Upward departure.
Upward departure, I apologize. That the analysis on this is cabined by the fact that prior to the absconding, the guideline range was 162 to 210 months, no motion for upward departure. After the absconding, there's a motion for upward departure filed on the basis of the absconding, and Judge Duffy did not address it in terms of a variance, which deals with the 3553 factors, but he did it in terms of a departure based on the guidelines of 3C1.1. Number three, with respect to the what government counsel has referred to as the 6 months of inactivity on the case. Again, the record is silent in terms of what goes on from January through June. Mr. Penninger is appointed new counsel in June, and it is that point that counsel begins to diligently prepare and make requests for specific things. Neither Mr. Penninger nor Mr. Kuhn should be penalized for the lack of record prior to that. And then the fourth issue, Your Honors, would be with respect to changing horses in the stream, as counsel has alleged with respect to Mrs. Bonita May. It was not until after trial that Mr. Kuhn, trial counsel, found that Mr. LeDoyne III's 1014 false statement conviction with respect to the bank record, that bank record was in fact authored by Miss Bonita May's daughter, Rachel May. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I don't need one. It's up to you guys.
All right, we'll come down to